Welcome back to another episode of Straight Up. How is everyone doing today? We're here, Kath and Elle, as always, tuning in, ready to bring you another very exciting episode, or actually an episode with a twist, we might say, right, honey?
Yes, it is.
Well, it's a bit of a podcasting collab. It's Straight Up times Sentimental Garbage, Caroline O'Donoghue.
We absolutely love her.
Legend. We're obsessed. If you don't know, guys, she is the host of the incredible culture podcast Sentimental Garbage, which basically looks at culture that society deems kind of wet or overly feminine or trash, and looks at it in an intellectual way. We discovered it through her shared series with Dolly Alderton, Sentimental in the City, all about Sex in the City.
She is so intellectual. After the recording, we were both like, my God, she is clever and wise and funny and hot. Got it all.
But like effortlessly so.
Yeah.
She really does. She's a New York Times bestselling author. She's published 6 books. Her YA, like young adult fiction, has done incredibly well. That's the New York Times bestselling trilogy, I think. Yeah. Her new book, The Rachel Incident, is out now. That's what this interview was pegged to.
So good.
Can I just say, I devoured it over the weekend. It's such a page turner. It's like, as we say, just like her, like effortlessly clever, very intellectually stimulating, but not in a posery way. It's not annoying. It was actually, I must say, don't you think, and this isn't to kind of put all Irish fiction into one camp, but it was definitely giving Sally Rooney Conversations with Friends.
Yes, but at her least pretentious and least annoying.
Exactly. In a much more like fun, upbeat, compelling, less infuriating way.
Exactly.
Quite frankly.
And we're not just saying that because they're both Irish.
No. So the book follows Rachel, who is happily married and pregnant, and she's looking back on time in her life at Cork Uni when she was living with her best friend, James, who in the kind of present tense is a very successful writer living in New York. But in the time of the book, when they're young, they meet at a bookshop, he's in the closet, and the book basically follows the whole debacle that transpires when they decide to seduce Rachel's college professor because she develops a crush on him. And I won't say too much
else. Dot, dot, dot. It's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous book. We talked all about her mental journey to writing the book in 11 weeks, which, if you know anything about publishing, is pretty much unheard of. She talked about some fabulous celebrity gossip, her favourite showbiz stories.
Oh, she did.
And
actually, guys, we had not, full disclaimer, read the book when we did the interview. So do not feel that you need to have read The Rachel Incident yet. We actually highly recommend having a listen and then going away and ordering your copy immediately after.
Yes. God, it's become a bit of a running theme of us not bothering to read the books of our guests before we interview them.
It's not a good look, is it? It's really embarrassing. Like, I was literally mortified in that publisher's office to be like, yes, we have not yet read the book. However, Caroline did say she was quite pleased about it because lots of our other promo has been very book focused and quite heavy. So this was a slightly fluffy chat, let's say, comparatively.
Yeah, she was thrilled not to have to talk about her book, honestly, for a little bit. It wasn't because we couldn't be bothered to read it, it's because we hadn't received it in time. It was a comms issue. Anyway, we'll let you get into it, guys. Oh, also we must say, please can you vote for us in the podcast awards for the listener's choice category. If you've been listening to the podcast over the years, then we'd really appreciate it. It takes 10 seconds. I'm going to give you the URL right now. So to vote, please head to britishpodcastawards.com voting. And the category is listener's choice. It literally takes 10 seconds. And then make sure you confirm your vote in your email afterwards. We would love you forever. Thank you.
Thank you so much, guys. Enjoy.
Enjoy.
Caroline, thank you so much for coming on Straight Up. You're one of our favourite podcasters, personally.
Oh, no, that's so nice. Yeah. Thank you so much.
But obviously, you are primarily a novelist, a writer.
And to kick off proceedings, we have got a Cosmo for you.
Oh, delightful.
A very chic canned Cosmo, because you love Sex and the City, and
yes,
we always record over a drink.
I know. We had so many of these when we were recording.
Oh my God, sorry. Are you kind of sick of them?
Did you?
No,
you
guys, yeah. Well, it's such a kind of like a Proustian thing now that whenever I have them, I feel like I'm back on that Zoom call with Dolly again. But also, obviously, I would always have them from a can and she would always have mixed them like properly.
Did them properly.
Yeah. And that's just, that's the whole thing, yeah.
Oh, she's like very chic.
Everything she does
doing
is chic
properly. Yeah, just Sentimental in the City was my first introduction to Sentimental Garbage. That's
Yeah, I think that's the same for a lot of people. Yes. Yeah, and it's lovely.
Just too good.
Thanks.
Too good. We always start with a little icebreaker.
Okay.
Which is, when is the last time you had slightly too much to drink?
oh, that's happening a lot at the moment. And I am like, oh God, is it a problem? Do you know, it's so hard because like we're having such like gorgeous weather at the moment. And I feel know. Like we're so, it's so difficult to know what to do with the extra hours and not get battered.
It is really hard. In the evening, you just suddenly feel like when you finish doing things at 5 or 6, you're the world is my oyster. You've got I should be in a pub.
Exactly. Yeah. And you want to get your Aperol spritz on or whatever. And it's tricky. It's tricky, tricky, tricky.
So tell us about an absolute bender.
Right. I'm trying to think of the last
you can remember.
True bender. I definitely had like a vague piss up the other night because we launched the book on Monday night. And then after, it's like after we went for some pints and I left my shoes in the glasshouse doors. So I had to come back for that, a tail between my legs the next morning. But in terms of like being absolutely battered, I'm trying to replace myself because I know it's been lately.
Well, you're celebrating. I feel like you're in launch mode. It's fine.
Yeah, it is fine. And thank you.
Yeah. It must feel like a real... like moment though, like you say, because how long did the book take to write, if you don't mind me asking?
Do you know, it's really different to everything else I've written in that it was such a short amount of time to write. And it's because it's stuff that I've spent like, you know, over a year or 2 years writing, and then they've come out to fairly like lukewarm response. And this I spent 11 weeks writing, and it's like the only time people have been like, well, not the only time, but like it's been the most response I've had.
You wrote
any
it
book
in
ever.
11 weeks.
It's nuts. It's not normal. It's not how people should write books. But it was just this
two
this,
and a bit months.
Yeah.
Oh my
that
god.
That must be the best how? Business movie
I
ever
know.
Made.
It's insane. It's really weird. It's so what kind of happened was is that I was working on another book and I realized that it wasn't going to work out, and I'd been working on that book for 2 years and it had been like, it was 70,000 words long it was just going nowhere. And I was like, not only do I not like writing this, I don't ever want to sit in a podcast room with two girls and pretend like I do like it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, because the thing is, when you don't believe in what you're writing, even when you're writing it, like how are you going to pretend in 2 years time or when, however long
promo.
Yeah, when you're doing promo, it's impossible.
How would, well, can you tell us what it was about, or is it too triggering?
No, not at all. It was, you know, and maybe the kind of vague subject matter will be worth coming back to one day, but I was very interested in sort of, you know, the kind of like the post how to be a woman kind of, we're all so jazzed about feminism moment that was lasted for about 6 years and now nobody talks about feminism anymore.
Yeah, it's deeply uncool, isn't it?
Yeah. It's and that's strange, isn't it? And
oh, then, so annoying.
And then also like, the idea was kind of a vaguely Black Mirror vibe set in a kind of a contemporary, a business that was all about feminism. And it was like, I was really interested in what happens when you get like an ideological movement that like so many young girls are jazzed about and ready to throw their efforts into, versus like when you're trying to run a business that way, when you're trying to girl bossify feminism, you know, and you're naturally, you, those things can't coexist. If something's supposed to be an ideal and also be subject to the demands of capitalism, like how does one thing end up contorting the other? And that was really interesting to me, particularly as I had worked at this feminist lifestyle publication called The Pool for many years.
Yes, which we loved.
Yeah, I mean, we all loved it, didn't we?
Yeah. Sad, depressing
times. Too bad
it
was incredibly badly run.
Yeah. Yes. Never paid their invoices.
That's it, yeah.
Oh God, so did the writers totally ever get paid in the end? Do we know?
No. Do you know what's John's even more embarrassing about that? Not only were the writers and staffers not paid, but there was like basically a GoFundMe online for our unpaid invoices. And like this woman who like wasn't even a member of staff, she was like a literary agent who was like, do you want me to organize this for you? Because I'm quite worried about you ladies. And so we all got like she was very official about it. I think her name is Julia Kingford. We sent in all our invoices to her. She crowdfunded on behalf of us. And then she all gave us like a proportion of what we were owed. Obviously, she didn't get the whole amount back.
But it was a good amount. Did you get a good amount
nice
back?
I think I got about 600 quid back and I was owed about 2.5 grand. But some people were owed like 9 or 10 grand. Like, it was nuts.
As a freelancer as well.
As a freelancer.
Oh my God.
Crazy.
Yeah, that's like
nuts. I
actually don't know what I would do in that scenario. Like, if someone owed me that kind of money, someone owed me a grand recently and I literally went ham. Like, I kicked off.
And you know, I don't know if you feel this way, but like now that I'm like in a position where I'm paying other people to do things for me, like paying like, you know, a podcast studio or all these kind of things, the minute I get the invoice through, I am, you know, and I hope as millennial bosses that we're
all
we've learned from, like, I'm sorry, the payment system hasn't had a chance to register yet, and you must send through a new invoice with email.
Okay, so like, I must say, as someone that has to put in many payments every day through the Telegraph, it okay. is sometimes, often, genuinely the account's fault. Like, there is a problem with the accounts, and they haven't registered or something, and it's not me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do sympathise with that, and it's not your fault at all.
But I've put through late interest payments, like late fee payments.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Very rarely does a publication acknowledge those. Because often you use the late fee payment thing.
As a threat.
As a threat. And then they pay you the original amount, and then we just, you part ways from there. But yeah, like, I was very inspired by that time that we had all, it was quite a literal manifestation of, like, so many young women had put their blood, sweat and tears into this company. And we all got shafted.
It's actually deeply ironic, actually, isn't it? It's like a female empowerment platform that just rinsed them.
Yeah.
Not on purpose, obviously.
Not on purpose, no, of course. And I'm willing to believe that there were things outside of their control. But I also think that there were better ways to handle it.
Yes, I think don't run a female platform if you can't run it. Like, that's irritating.
Yeah. Well, precisely.
So I would like to know how it feels as someone who literally can't even throw away a shit article of 900 words. How do you manage to part ways with 70,000 words?
How did you do that?
Yes, we got off track there with me bitching about my former employers. So I'd gotten 70K in or whatever, and my publishers, whose offices we're sitting in right now, they were like, you know, you're quite late with this. We do need something by May. And this was February of 21. And I was like, I can't give them this. And I don't want to try anymore because I've been trying and trying and trying for ages. And it's just all I get is a few more thousand words of, like, description and no onward moving plot and no stakes and just, like, really drab. And, like, I gave it to my best friend, Ella Risbridger, and she is always my first reader for everything. And she's so enthusiastic and she always sees what I'm trying to do and she always drags out the best of it and says, I think this is what you're interested in. And then she took like 3 weeks to get back to me, and we were sitting in like a children's park by a slide. And it was almost like a breakup. It was so weird. She was like, I have to be honest with you. I just didn't dig it. I didn't feel like it didn't really jump off the page for me. It felt like you were quite miserable writing it. And I just started crying and I was like, because I am miserable writing this. But I was like, okay, I need the money because the way book publishing works, like you sign a deal, you get a proportion of the fee and then you get another proportion when you submit the final draft. And this was COVID. There wasn't a lot of ways to earn money, you know. So I needed to write something. And I had this note in my phone that was like, you know, a novel about a young woman living with her best friend in Cork in 2010, which is what I did. And then, you know, he's in the closet and them sort of navigating sort of very much an indie sleaze vibe world together. And then the rest of the plot just came really quickly and it was just like a very ornate soap opera and it all just gelled together. And something about the unique pressures of like it being COVID, it being something that was very much based in memory. And I really feel like, I don't know if you guys had this in COVID, where like you stood very still and there was no new memories happening. So you were obsessively processing old memories.
So true.
And that, and also the fact that this was about a very happy time in my life. And it was like, it really got me out of bed every morning. I was like, yes, I get to like revisit this really fun time in my life. And also that it needed to be done in 11 weeks. Like it took 11 weeks because it needed to be done in 11 weeks, you know?
Were you doing like serious 12-hour shifts?
Yeah. And it was because it was also exactly the time frame that me and Dolly were recording Sentimental in the City.
Oh God!
It was actually.
Oh my God! How did you have time to do both?
Well, it's funny when you read the book, you'll see that like there's quite a few bits that from Sentimental in the City in the book, and that's.
Oh, I love that.
I know, it's kind of great because it sort of seems like me doing an Alfred Hitchcock, like me writing myself in and winking.
Very meta.
Yeah, very meta. But then it was like. We were just like, you know, that sort of catchphrase we came up with that was like, very a play. Which like, we had been saying that for months before we were saying it on the podcast. And I thought it was so funny that I made a like, private joke between the two characters in this thing. And also, If no one's listened to that podcast, I'd be like, why? What? What is Mary a play? And then it just like, I just thought it was a funny, because you do that as a novelist. You take jokes from your life and you put them into a thing. And now it's become, it's like people I meet in the world who I've never met, they just go like, ah, Mary a play. Oh, and it's like, very cool. I really like it.
They're like in on the joke.
Yeah, and that's very rare that you can do that with a piece of fiction, that you can include people in on the joke from day one, you know?
So can we just 1 minute of nerding for a second for fellow nerds? But like, literally, how many words were you writing a day? I can't even... You must have been just writing all day from like dawn.
Yeah. No, do you know, I think the first draft was, you know, 60 or 70,000 words. It was only, it was like 3 or 4,000 words a day, but it was every day. And
that is a lot.
It was a lot, but I was really energized by it, and there was nothing else to do. And so it was just like, I would write all day, and then I would either watch Sex and City in the evening, or I would talk about it with Dolly in the evening. And that was like my whole life. It was like kind of, I don't know.
Sounds quite dreamy, actually.
It was the worst part of lockdown, because remember, it was like the horrible weather, and like Christmas had just been cancelled, and everyone was so miserable and sad. But it was also kind of a very monastic time, it felt. I felt like I was like illuminating a manuscript in my tower in the 15th century, you know?
Did you literally feel, with that, with an idea like that when it happens so fast, did you have that like typically stereotypical novelist thing of like, the words just flow through me? It's just all coming out.
For the first time ever, And this is like my sixth novel as well. So it's like, I feel like you get thrown a freebie by the universe every now and then. Like the other ones are just like mulish work. And then every now and then the gods of writing go like, you've earned an easy ride. And I'm having a really easy ride with this. It's weird because like I wrote it really quickly. I had a lot of fun writing it. Like the publisher from America like snapped it up right away. The movie rights got snapped up right away. It's getting great reviews. I'm having a great time. It's like,
oh my God.
I'm like, but I know. Thanks very much.
Clink Cosmos.
Clink clink.
Let's hope that there is not something bad around the corner.
But like that's the thing. I know that like I hope I'm still doing this job when I'm like Margaret Atwood's age, and it's not always going to be like this. Like there's going to be really difficult novels. There's going to be commercial failures. There's going to be critical failures. There's going to be like, oh no, I said something insensitive and now I'm cancelled with the community I had never even like thought I could, you know, offend or something. But like, so you have to just appreciate things when they're going well. And I've spent a lot of time of my life not enjoying the moment because I thought that it would tempt bad fate, you know?
Interesting.
Do you like that at all?
I mean, I'm not... I don't know. I'm not, one thing I do have is that I'm not very good with excitement. So like I very rarely actually genuinely feel excited. So you'll say like, oh, I'm so excited for like this thing. Yeah. But like, it's actually really unusual that I genuinely have that feeling like of like.
It's really hard to not, I think it's because we're living in such an anxiety age, to not convert excitement immediately into anxiety.
Yeah. Yes. And they are the same kind of physical feeling, aren't they?
They
like
are.
One of those little neuro tricks is supposed to be when you feel anxious or nervous about something. You're like, I'm actually really excited about this.
It's all just adrenaline, isn't it? And like, Gav always says this to me whenever I'm like nervous before publication week. He's like, what if you were just excited?
That's a trick you gave me, which really helps when I did a talk the other day.
Just like reframe it in your head.
Yeah, reframe it.
Because you must spend so much of your working life like on your own. That's actually something I'm struggling with a bit, having become a freelancer, just because I hadn't thought about how much you get from just communicating with other people that aren't even necessarily like close colleagues or friends, but just those daily interactions that I now like don't have. Yeah. Have you found that you've got to like build that into your day, or do you like being alone?
That's why I got a podcast. I assume that's why you kind of have a podcast as well, is that like when I went freelance full time in 2018 and I found the loneliness of it really crushing, and I was like, I need an excuse to go out and meet people and like get out of my comfort zone and all that. And that's where the podcast came from. And now I'm doing a bit more script writing, and that's way more collaborative. And I thought I was looking forward to that. I'm really enjoying it, but like, I forgot how much becoming a novelist has made me a control freak as well, where it's like, you have to listen to other people's ideas, and it's like, no.
So script writing, are you already working on the Rachel Incident?
Yeah, I'm working on the Rachel Incident.
And have you got a writer's room? Like, what's the deal with that? Do you write the whole thing, or do you have to co-write it?
I am just me at the moment, but if it gets greenlit, so it's in production, so it's not officially been greenlit, but when it does, I hope there will be a little bit of a writer's room.
How exciting. Have you've been in writer's rooms before?
Weirdly, I appear to have skipped that step.
What?
It's very jammy.
That's not amazing.
I don't know how it's happened, but I think it's possibly, maybe this is the wonder of podcasts, because I do so much cultural analysis on the podcast, I had quite a few people reach out and be like, oh, do you want to write an episode of this? Ooh, or come in for fun. A meeting about that. And so weirdly, I've gotten like people have like, you listen to me dissect a movie or a TV show and be like, oh, it seems like you have a good handle on story structure. And then they seek out my books and then we have meetings and it's all going so well. I haven't actually had anything committed to screen yet. So I've just like done lots of scripts.
Because I did go and have a little stalk of your IMDb. Yeah. I did see The Better Man.
Oh my God.
From 2013. And then and then there was nothing after that. So I was like, oh God, was it?
Oh God.
Did you?
No,
did
that you? It's that's so funny. That was like, God, I've never been asked about that. That's so funny.
Well, welcome to two journalists. And
yeah. No, me and my friends, we made a movie. I mean, I say we, it was very much them. And I was brought on to be kind of a script doctor.
You're a co-writer.
I mean, yeah. It was like, you know how you found out after Carrie Fisher died that she like rewrote everything? my pals, when I first moved here, I became friends with them. And they were just this gang of like, and I'm still friends with them, but them still this boy writers who were, they were all trying to be the next like Kevin Smith or whatever. And I'm sure they still will be, but like they wrote this script about a man, a boy who gets engaged right out of school and his friends throwing a stag do for him and being like, this is really weird. And then they got the script and they realized they were like, oh, all the women aren't people. Right. And it was just at this advent in like when that feminism sort of that period that we were all so excited about was really revving up and they were quite mindful that all the women were quite badly written. Mm. And so they sort of found me. Even though we didn't really know each other very well, and I sort of rewrote the entire script, and then we became really good friends because through it. So it was like a very standalone project. It got a few awards and things.
Yeah, it looked good. Yeah,
thanks. Yeah,
from what I could see.
I'm sure it holds up okay. I haven't seen it in years, but yeah, that was a interesting project. But now, yeah, it's this kind of screenwriting arm of my career. Now it's yeah, it's all just scripts still. Nothing's actually been produced yet. So I don't really know how good I am at it yet.
I guess we are in the midst of a writer's strike and everything's on hold.
That's generally a real pain in the ass.
Growing up, did you always want to be a writer?
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I think like people who are writers, they're either have something incredible to say or they have been narrowed into a corner by their own lack of gifts elsewhere.
Okay. In my case.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Where like I'm very badly organized, not very numerically illiterate. Like I kind of have to count on my fingers still. Mm. Very uncoordinated, very bad at reaching all the classic.
Sounds quite familiar for both of us.
I'm surprised I know my left and right. That's
I literally sometimes do that. I'm not joking.
Like totally, yeah, doing the thumb and the forefinger.
Just need to double check this.
Yeah, and but then it being like and really bad at school and just failing everything or whatever, but writing being the only thing that I could do, and I just sort of followed that to its natural nth degree. And I meet a lot of people who are wannabe writers or whatever, and particularly because I talk to a lot of teenagers, and a lot of them say like, you know, oh, I'm interested in writing and I'm interested in drama and I'm interested in science and I'm interested in all these things. But I think I'd like to write a book one day. And in my head, I'm like, never going to fucking happen.
Yeah.
Which I never say out loud.
Yeah. But I think
it's so rare for good old rounders to actually
That's
commit to a project
point.
Like
That's
that.
That's a very good point.
Do you think? Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
I think you're right.
Have you felt always that you have something to say? If you know what I mean, because that's definitely something that I've struggled with a little bit in journalism. Some journalists are so able to like really embrace like having a voice, like you're saying, whereas sometimes I've always felt like, why does what I think matter? Or like, why is my voice more important than anyone else's? Mm. Probably not an ideal mindset for a journalist, but
totally
it's something I've noticed.
It's interesting because we must on some level think that our opinions are incredibly important. Yeah. Because like, why else would I plug my entire life into
printing pages of your own
pages and pages of my own thoughts, and also hundreds of hours of my own thoughts on things no one cares about. like you know, it is interesting to be like, yeah, it's weird because I consider myself intellectually very insecure, as I just said, you know, and I think it comes from kind of a background of not being a great performer or whatever in school. And I would get like, for example, if like I ever hear from like, as you know, as a journalist, like you write a piece about something or other and then somebody a radio show, for example, will reach out to you and be like, do you want to come on and debate this with so-and-so? And I would always be like, no, I don't. I'm not sure of my own thoughts at all. And I'm so afraid that my mind could be changed and that it would be changed humiliatingly on
which is actually a good thing, but it doesn't sound good.
It doesn't make good debate. It doesn't make radio.
Yeah, totally. I remember I said yes to that once. I really learned my lesson. It was such an anodyne topic. It was like, I had written some like very fluffy piece about like, why I loved going to an all-girls school. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You know that era of journalism where it was like, in defense of cardigans. Yeah. Like, it was a real gold rush. But I'd written something like that. And then this radio DJ, radio producer kind of rang me up being like, right, we're doing a segment on this, girls' schools versus mixed schools, come on or whatever. And I was like, grand, yeah, I'll share some fond memories of my girls' school. And then it was like immediately so intense.
Oh God.
It was like, neurologically, people say that, you know, mixed schools are better for this. And I was like, I don't actually care.
It's just quite fun.
I'm just a fun gal having some thoughts. I don't really mind. I don't really want to convince anyone. And you only make that mistake once, I think.
Yeah. I actually didn't want to die on this hill. But
no, exactly. You're like, I really didn't want to die on this hill. I don't care.
I don't want to be like the number one spokesperson for single sex education.
Yeah.
But somehow I am.
What an incredible thing to be the person for. But then I've done so many events now. And when I first started, I'm sure you're the same, but like when I first started off doing panels or talks or workshops or whatever, I would like swat for like days and days. And on the train down, I'd be going over the notes obsessively. And now increasingly I'm like, I don't really need to look at my notes that much. And then it's like, I think I'll go out the night before. And like, if you do that job for 40 years, how slim does your sort of like faith in yourself become? Do you know what I mean? Like,
or how? Until you have a shocker.
Until you have a fucking shocker. I remembered the answer to your earlier question, by the way, about when was last time I was shit-faced.
Go on.
Go on.
It was last week. And and you know what? I struggled for a minute answering your question because I tend to be the person who just like, I'm a much better stoner than I am a drinker, and that I tend to like have a few pints or a few drinks and then I get a bit sleepy and then I switch to water because I don't get like mad. I just get a bit tired. But I was having... I had a liquid lunch with Emma Jane Unsworth and Dolly Alderton. And we were in the French house and we got a bottle of champagne and then another bottle of champagne. And we were celebrating something. And then we went to this members only club. And I was like, oh, this is what it's all about. This is why you become an author, so you can sit in the middle of the day and you can drink with other authors. And I was so wrecked.
Literally, your Carrie Bradshaw moment.
Yeah, and like you only have those moments like a couple of times a year, really, where you just like, look at us, we're all fabulous and we're all doing it. Yeah. We're like smoking like one fag off the other or whatever. And I was like, this is great. This is what it's all about. And then in the members club that we were in, Virago, who are my publishers... who are turning 50 this year and they have a string of events celebrating their...
We just ate one of their 50th celebration.
I know, yeah. One of them has a fanny on it.
Oh, yes, we haven't eaten that one.
Yes, I think we know why. But they were like holding an event in one of the spaces or whatever, and they came out into the garden and like this, like the sunshine was beating down, no one had a speck of water in 5 hours, like I was like teetering or whatever, and then my publicist Grace comes over, she's like, hello. And I was just like, I felt like a kid who was caught by their parents.
Was it immediately kind of obvious that you were throwing to the wind?
Totally. And also I was like also doing that thing of like, obviously you get invited to a lot of events and you can't go to them all. You can't go to all the panels or whatever. And so thinking like, oh God, there must have been a point where I was invited to this and
as
didn't,
a speaker?
Maybe, who knows? Maybe, or even just a guest member. And I must have said no, or I might have said no. And now I'm
but
here.
You're busy.
Because I'm busy. Because I'm like, I probably wrote something like, if they even asked me, maybe they did. I have no idea. I can't check. I'm too ashamed of being like, hi guys, you know, press for the Rachel incident has been really intense and I really need some downtime. And like, man, I'm just like in this members club going, hello.
I am with other writers. This was technically work adjacent.
That's what's going on my taxes anyway.
Did you then have to make small talk with people at the other party, or was it? Did you just stay?
Luckily, I've been at this publisher's for years, so it's like I've known them since I was 24. You know, so it's great. It's fine.
It's okay.
It was fine, and like I'm really close with my editor and my publisher. It was they thought it was really funny and it was great. But then at one point, then Emma left, and then eventually Dolly had to leave, and I was just me sort of tanked up sitting there being like, well, I do know people here. And then I just sort of like teetered in my massive shoes because obviously I got dressed up to see friends or whatever. Teetered into the space where they were having the event. And it was such an earnest and sincere chat about like the state of modern, you know, feminism and activism. Oh, and I just clomped in and like plopped down. I was so embarrassed, but I also knew I was...
very modern feminist.
Very. It was not good. I feel I know Grace will be listening to this now, and I'm so sorry, Grace.
No, this is your time to apologise.
Yeah. I'm really sorry to Grace and to my publishers.
But talking of glamorous events, we do like to ask, what has been the most surreal showbiz event that you've ever attended?
Gang, I don't know about you, but I am always trying to find ways to sprinkle my weekends with things that don't just revolve around drinking, like going to the pub. I try and include one wholesome activity that I feel inspires me creatively in some way, be that watching a good film or seeing an amazing art exhibition.
Same here, babe. It's always good to take in some culture, which is why we're so pleased that our new sponsor is the Art Fund's National Art Pass, an amazing pass that allows you to go and see paid exhibitions at museums and at art galleries at a fantastic 50% discount, valid for major galleries from the Tate to the National Gallery and the V&A. Some partnered venues are even free with the pass, such as the Brighton Pavilion, my fave, Cardiff Castle and Ham House.
I love it so much that my boyfriend and I have actually bought several passes for friends as gifts. They're perfect for birthdays. And for those interested in getting one of these amazing culture passes, excitingly, we have a fabulous extra discount for you.
Yes, we do. Until the 30th of June, you can try a 3-month trial National Art Pass for just £15. And our gorgeous listeners can also add a free plus one to their trial membership with promo code Straight Up. So it really is such a perfect way to do a wholesome date day with a friend or your significant other. Els, please tell me, what have you used your card for recently?
I loved After Impressionism at the National Gallery, which is on until mid-August because I just love Cezanne and Van Gogh. I went with a friend on a sunny Sunday morning, then we had lunch together in St. James's Park and it was such a cute day. What about you, hon?
So cute, so wholesome. I love it. I am so, so excited to see Yayoi Kusama at the Tate Modern. You know, the gorgeous infinity light rooms that you've probably seen all over Instagram?
Yes, stunning. And if the fact that these exhibitions are half price with the Art Pass wasn't enough to convince you, then warm your heart in knowing Art Fund is the national fundraising charity for art. And so buying an Art Pass helps Art Fund support museums, galleries and historic places across the UK.
Head to artfund.org/national-art-pass to grab your 3-month trial National Art Pass for just £15. And do not forget to add your free plus one to your trial membership with the promo code Straight Up. That's all in caps, all one word, Straight Up. Thank you so much to Art Fund.
Do you know what? It's going to be tonight, I think.
Ooh, what is it?
I can't tell you who, but I'm meeting a movie star tonight.
For the Rachel Incident adaptation?
Yeah.
Ooh. Are you going to wine and dine them?
Well, it's like, I think it's going to be a really quick meeting. It's going to be like a, hey, how's it going? I'm pretty sure it's going to be that. But I can't think about anything else.
Who are they playing in the book?
All right, I'm just going to tell you who it is. So it's like, I'm meeting Elliot Page tonight.
Oh my God.
It's going to be so embarrassing if he like cancels, because he probably will, because he's the busiest man in the world.
Yes.
But his production company bought the rights to the Rachel Incident.
Oh.
And so he's not playing anyone, but he is a producer.
Oh my God.
And even though I've been dealing with, they're an amazing company, they make loads of great stuff, but like, I haven't actually met him yet. And I'm meeting him tonight. And
Have you read his memoir?
Yes.
Oh my goodness, that's really exciting. How do you prep for like a big showbiz meeting then? Will you have your outfit ready?
It's like, what?
Do you come in like, hello, I am the
I'm
author.
Really para, because he's really short. And I'm like, I would generally wear heels to a thing like this, but I don't want to like, what if we hug and I'm really hot and then like his
in the armpit.
His head is in my armpit. The breast.
I had to refuse a handshake when we met earlier on that principle that my hands are very clammy.
Yes, exactly. And like, he's really cool and Canadian. Yeah. And like, do I wear like a dress? Because we're going to be meeting in the context of a very nice event. Like, do I wear like a dress or whatever? Or just be like...
Casual.
A jumpsuit?
Maybe a jumpsuit.
Yeah, that's your go-to for a smart occasion.
Do you know what? I've never embraced the jumpsuit myself.
It's very good.
I find them a little tricky.
It also means you can sit down at any moment.
I think...
On the floor.
They're so dependent on the vagaries of proportions, aren't they? Because you could just... If you got a long middle or something, you can get that seam up your
That's
fanny.
That's what happens to me quite often. Yeah,
so I never wear them. And so, because I'm planning a wedding as well, so many people have said, are you going to have like a white jumpsuit that you change into?
It's like Trouser Bride.
Jazzy Bride,
Oh, you're just going to have a little mini mini dress instead.
Yeah, well, who knows? Yeah.
I mean, for the change.
I'm not going to do an outfit change. I've already
made
my decision.
Oh, no, well, that's because your dress is too stunning.
Well, I haven't even got a dress yet, but I have a dream dress, but I'm like...
Oh, yeah, what is it?
It's Vivienne Westwood.
Oh, my God. So I'm like,
I know, I don't know, but I'm like, if I did wear that, then like, hell, I'm only wearing it for like 4 hours.
You must
get
it. It is the best thing I've ever seen on you.
But I don't know. I just think an outfit change is just too much to commit to when you're already worrying about everything else.
Yeah, I'm still wondering about the outfit change as well.
I think it's more just to preserve the dress, because every wedding I've been to, the bride has been completely incoherent about 2 a.m.
That's it.
But the dress is going to need dry cleaning anyway, you know? So
So even though she did an outfit change, one bride has to have it all cut off because the hem is so dirty because she went to an Edinburgh nightclub afterwards, which is iconic.
That is cool, though.
So tonight will be your most glamorous moment. How exciting.
I know. Yeah, I'm trying to think of the other moments because I'm sure there has been some.
Some parties when you're like, what the hell am I doing here?
What the hell am I doing here? Yeah. Oh, actually, I do remember one. Me and Gav, we went to the Letters of Note after party.
Oh.
And it was at the Royal Albert Hall. And the reason we were there is very sweet. It was because Dolly was doing a reading of one of the things and she invited us as her plus ones.
Oh.
Mom and Dad.
So is Gav your partner?
He is, yeah.
The one you've been with for many years?
Yes, many years.
Because I wrote on our notes, like, I think they've been together for 9 years, but...
That's correct, yeah. 9 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, we both went to that and then we went to the after party afterwards and like... I remember I got around in and I looked behind me and I was like, oh my God, that's Robert Pattinson.
Ooh.
Was he with Suki Waterhouse?
Yes, he was. I didn't know that was the time. I was just like small blonde woman. Mm. And like there were so many things.
Did he have the strange hair?
Yeah. I gotta say.
It just looks like it's... Yeah. He's never been washed. It's never been washed.
Well, he sort of looked like a kind of, if you were going as a Halloween costume, as a sort of a celebrity incognito. That's what he looked like. He was like a baseball cap indoors kind of thing.
Oh.
Yeah. But, you know, I see.
That's very DiCaprio, actually.
Yeah, I'm sure it's very nice. Yeah.
So how do you feel about being like visible in the public eye? Because forgive the assumption, I could be wrong, but I feel your brand is quite more like, as you say, you do panels and things, but you are first and foremost like a writer rather than a kind of literary influencer, let's say. Yes. Well, I don't know, I feel like you're in the business of writing rather than making lots of reels about your holidays and things, you know? Not to say that there's anything wrong with that at all. I wish as a writer, I know I need to like step up my social media game and that it can be like very valuable, but equally obviously writers are writers and it can be quite tricky to have a social media brand on top of that. Have you made the kind of conscious choice to not have too much of a
brand? I'm really curious about how it all comes across to you because I'm really fluctuating with it all the time. I feel like my relationship with it, particularly right now, is changing a lot.
Well, I thought you deleted your Instagram, but then I saw that in fact you'd had it taken down or something.
Yes, Taylor Swift took it away.
Right, because of the Midnights.
No, I just decided that she did. Because me and my friend Jen did a podcast about Midnights. Yeah. We actually did two. And then very quickly afterwards, my Instagram was deleted by Instagram.
Oh.
And they were like, you're impersonating a public figure.
Wow.
And we were like, Taylor didn't like it and she's so powerful she can get rid of anybody.
Interesting.
So I like putting that urban myth out in there.
Okay.
I love that myth.
Yes. I would say my perception is just that you're not necessarily the kind of like writer who is first and foremost concerned with your online image.
Yeah.
You're more about actually writing 6 books.
which is
quite the achievement.
It's funny because I was always someone, I'm always someone who like really enjoyed social media. Like even when I was like a really young teenager, I don't know if you guys are the same, I was like going on forums and chat rooms and like the essential romance of the internet is still so sexy to me. The idea that you can like, you know, put a message in a bottle out and then anybody could see it. And I've always been good at it as well. You know, when I was posting on forums back in the day, I had like 11,000 posts and I was like a member of the community, you know. And then I got onto Twitter and I think as well because I moved here in 2011 and I knew nobody and all I wanted to do was write. And, you know, I don't know if this is necessarily true, but it certainly felt this way to me at the time that like everybody who got the jobs that I wanted, they grew up in London, they were from a very specific network of schools or whatever. And not even like incredible schools, like just it seemed like everybody had gone to the same 3 or 4 universities.
And they all know each other.
And they all know each other.
Journalism can be quite cliquey like that, I think.
Yeah, and they had all done the same MMAs
or
whatever. And it felt really like there was no space at all. for people who were unconnected or from somewhere else. And all the experience that I had, which was like writing for my local paper back in Cork, which I thought my portfolio was really strong. Like I was like, look, I did this like profile of this rock band when I was 19 or whatever. Like I did all this stuff and like it counted for nothing. And I think that was because, especially then, the London media scene was so inward looking. It didn't really matter that you wrote somewhere else because it was all about here and now. And the only way you could get in was unpaid internships. And I couldn't afford to do more than one of those. And so Twitter was this like access point for like, it's like for some reason, whatever about the human brain, our brains are only evolved to be big enough to like have the size of a village in our heads.
Yeah, the tribe.
The tribe, exactly. And you can only really fit 300 people in your head at once, you know? And so somebody like emailing you being like, you know, dear thingy, here's my pitch and here's a writing sample. It won't go as far as like, oh, I know this girl's name from Twitter.
Yeah.
And that became my in for everything. And like I owe my whole career to Twitter. And so it comes from it naturally to me. And now I use Instagram a lot. But like, it sort of changed. I've always had this like kind of quite fine relationship with it. But now it's weird because people sort of built this relationship with me, which is really lovely during the pandemic. Because those podcasts that I did with Dolly, I'm so like proud of them. I'm so proud of like my tiny contribution to like pandemic art. Do you know what I mean? It's like I'm me and like the Queen's Gambit. Do you know what I mean? Or whatever. And it's so amazing that people were like at such a vulnerable point in their lives. And it's like, yes, it was about Sex and the City, and because everybody was traumatized to watch something new. So they were rewatching old stuff. And like I got so many messages from people, mainly women, who were like, I literally have been in the hospital all week in the waiting room while my father dies. And like, I'm just popping this in my ears because it's too stressful to talk to my own friends. But like just hearing two women nattering, you know, as I'm sure you hear all the time from your listeners, that like just the simple act of nattering is like
being silly.
Being silly. Exactly. And so I came out of lockdown with a different kind of a profile than what I went into it with. And so like I have much more people coming up to me in the street now, and like it's very cool.
So how often do you get, say, like approached on a monthly basis? Like
it's quite a bit at the moment because I'm doing art press and I feel like people have a better idea of what my face looks like or something. But I think it comes in waves. Like sometimes it'll be like three times in a night.
Oh my gosh.
I know, which I think is crazy. But then like if you walk down the street with Dolly, like you can't walk 20 paces without somebody coming up to her.
I have to say, I would recognise you if I walked past you in the street.
Do you think?
Yeah, 100%. I'd be like, oh my God, that's Caroline. I would. So.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. I still think of things that you guys talked about in the podcast. One point that I brought up to you and that I've thought of loads is when you mentioned, I hope you don't mind me talking about it on air. If you do, we can cut it out. Your kind of, I guess, relationship with whether you wanted to have children, be child-free by choice. And I remembered really significantly you saying about thinking that perhaps you didn't want children, you and your partner. And then after a particularly brilliant like professional success, you were said, oh, and then you sort of get up the next day and you've got to get your flat white, get your laptop out, and it's like back on the grind. And so it's like a different kind of achievement perhaps, or it reframed your like understanding of maybe what having kids would do. I don't know. I just always thought that was like such a fascinating point that you made, and I've thought about it like for like 2 years since you said that.
Do you think about it vis-a-vis your own?
Well, I definitely want to have kids. Yeah. I'm 32 this year. But I don't want them yet. And I've been with my partner for like 10 years. We're getting married next year. So like on paper, we should be like totally ready to have kids.
Yeah.
But I'm just not
We're
at
same.
All.
We're
yeah.
Exact same.
And I always thought growing up that I was like 100% that girl that would like be like so mothering and really want children. And now that I'm actually like at that place in life, I'm like, actually like, I kind of like my life how it is. And I can really recognize all these other amazing things that give you like so much value and purpose. I don't know, it's just really reframed as I got older. My perception of motherhood has changed.
So I was very of the opinion for a long time that I didn't want kids, and I think that's quite normal, isn't it? Like it's quite normal when you're in your 20s and like entirely you only want to think about yourself every single day forever. Like of course it's, you know, you don't want to. And then like the older I get, the more I'm like, oh, I definitely do want that. But also like if somebody, and I don't want to like trigger anyone or talk about, you know, obviously fertility is a very elastic thing and a very troubling thing. But like if somebody came to me tomorrow and said you could have your first child at the age of 38 and your second child at the age of 40 and you would be fine. And like you will have the ovaries of a 16-year-old then. And like that would be like, oh, phew. OK, I'll see you when I'm 38. So do you know what I mean? But I don't think, you know, you do run a risk of things being very difficult down the line if you do that. But I do, yeah, I think about that a lot of like, yes, if you have a child, your life will get infinitely harder. Like you, blah, blah, blah. Like, you know, we all know that. Like this thing will rely on you for everything all the time for years. But part of you also has to think, well, life is supposed to be hard. Like it's not supposed to be easy. And like the people who I know who have the easiest lives are also the most depressed. You know what I mean? So
interesting. Yes, actually, I would agree with that.
Yeah, they are the most, you know, I'm not saying that you have to have children in order to make your life hard, but I think I definitely know people who have removed very carefully every sort of boulder or hill or bit of gravel that might make them unhappy down the line, whether it's like refusing to commit to another person, refusing to sort of commit to a career path, or refusing of commitment in general. And they aren't very happy. I don't envy their lives.
Because everything is flat.
Because it does feel flat, you know?
And you need the peaks and troughs to even have a relative understanding of what happiness is.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Like, and you know, you like, I thought that was done. Did you see that show, Fleischman Is in Trouble?
Yes. Loved it.
I thought really it was so well done.
I read the book, but I was so put off by the reviews.
Yeah, you didn't like, because I watched the whole thing and I loved it. Yeah. But you weren't sure.
Well, I just never watched it because I'm one of those annoying journalists that takes reviews really seriously, even though they're always... Right. Completely divergent.
Even though we often disagree with reviews.
Even though we do.
Yeah, yeah. I take the reviews of people I hate very seriously. Like, there's a few book reviewers out there who, not because they've reviewed me badly, but I just always think they're wrong. And I love reading them being wrong and then buying the book. Yeah. but there was a scene, there was a whole thing in that. Who's the hot character that was in the OC? Adam Brody's character, yeah. Seth was the name of the character, which is also the name of his character in the shit.
Yes.
But, you know, the Fleischman character, he has this amazing night out with Seth. And it's like they end up like at an illegal boxing match at 3 a.m. and they wake up and they walk through the city and they buy a loaf of bread from the guys who are delivering the van. And then they go home and Fleischman is like, oh, my God, we were like kings of the night. It was incredible. And like, the Seth character is like, yeah, that's kind of like, he's so unmoved by the night he just had. It's a very normal thing for him. And it has also doesn't mean anything anymore. And he's like, I'm just the person that people go to have nights like that. And it's actually very hollow, you know.
God, that's really sad, isn't
it? I know, which is not to say that like fun sucks, because I do like fun.
So talking of another fun thing that we know you love, Sex and the City.
Yes.
Which when this comes out, the first episode
I can't believe you guys
dropped.
Have seen it and I haven't. I feel...
I know, well, I feel bad now because Ellie was like, oh, shall I ask Caroline's PR about screeners? And I was like, oh, she'll definitely have them.
I just
assumed you
would.
I can't believe we could be sitting here talking about it and we're not.
Well, I was also a bit nervous to ask in case it looked like we were trying to pip your podcast to the post.
Cannibalize.
So I was like,
sentimental.
If she's watching, she's watching.
No, definitely not. Because I think me and Dali will definitely do a sort of review podcast of it, but it will probably be 6 months after it comes out. So.
Okay. Well, maybe just more generally, how obsessed are you with Sex and the City? Like on just on a personal level, that when you're not preparing for the podcast necessarily, like, do you feel like you're thinking about the characters?
Oh my god,
all the
do you know
time?
What? I watched an episode the other day for the first time since we did that big recap kind of thing, and it was weird because I was talking to Dolly about it as well, and she was like, I've started watching it again as well.
Oh, ooh. Have you?
Yeah, I was writing a piece and I needed a quote, and I just like got up because I have them all on my Amazon Prime, and I just got up the episode and I was like, okay, I just need what that exact quote was. And then I just was like sat there watching the whole thing. It's so good. It's still unmatched.
I watched it for the first time in, I can't remember what year it was, 20, it was when I did my year abroad. So I was like 21. Yeah. And that was the first time I'd ever watched it. And I was so depressed in France with no friends. And it became like almost unstable. Like me thinking they were my real friends in like a country where I didn't have any.
Yeah.
So it's become like quite, it's always.
I think women feel very personal about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's your favourite character? I know you will have talked about this before, but...
My favourite? As in like of the four girls or in general of the whole franchise?
Ooh. Oh my God, both.
Oh God.
I love a bit of Anthony, if we're talking about the wider universe.
I love Anthony. Oh my God. Dali bought me a cameo from him at one point.
Oh my God, I love that. How much is this cameo?
It was nuts. I think it was like 70 quid.
Okay.
Which, you know...
It's not bad.
It's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot.
I remember at one point looking up who was the most highest paid person on Cameo. It's not who you'd expect. It's like one of those like not that famous but cult figures. Yeah, I can't remember now. Annoying.
I do love Bonnie McDougal. think yes. she's amazing.
Oh my God, Bunny.
Bunny. Oh my God. And sometimes she shows up in things as well. I think she's the actress is dead now. It's incredible. She's always Bunny McDougal, you know? I got really deep into it the other day, or not the day, but recently, of like, do you ever watch The Gilmore Girls?
No.
I found it. I tried to and it was just too cheesy for me.
It's so cheesy, to be fair.
I couldn't cope.
Yeah. But I just got into a whole sort of personal fan fiction about the characters. The characters knowing each other.
I love that.
Yeah.
I started rewatching Desperate Housewives last night and it was like a kind of whack over the head. I was like, oh my God, I know these characters so well. Like, I just hadn't thought about the individual housewives for such a long time. And then watching it again, I was like, whoa, Susan and Lynette.
It was such a mental show, tonally speaking, wasn't it?
Very
it was like
strange.
So camp and weird. And like, it was like a soap opera run through like some kind of weird, crazy neon filter, you know?
Like slight, so like dark. 50s adjacent, but also in the modern day. It was very strange.
Oh my God, the chokehold that Desperate Housewives has us all in. Do you know, actually, I was researching something recently for a short story I wrote about porn. And I was writing from the perspective of a porn star, porn actor. They're not all stars. But I was reading loads of memoirs written by porn stars. And one of them talked about how Desperate Housewives changed porn forever.
Oh, interesting.
Because the term sort of MILF became popular because of the Eva Longoria character.
That is so interesting.
It entered the sort of the culture for the first time. And then after that, MILF porn became this huge category and it never went away.
That is really interesting.
Evie was also very...
Edie, the blonde.
It was like someone famous.
She's that really famous, like bombshell actress.
Yes, and she was also in Kill Bill.
I've forgotten her name now.
No, it's not Daryl Hannah, but somebody else, and I can't remember.
I feel like she's
name.
Kind of the archetypal MILF in like a teen boy's brain, and so like blonde, like enormous tits. And
exactly.
Played up to the
MILF. But she's also like, she's very a porny MILF,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, she's a porny MILF.
Yeah.
And she actually had no kids in the show. Yes. She's like the resident single lady.
I actually quite liked her. God, she died a sad death, didn't she?
She does, I think.
Sorry,
you can get away with those spoilers.
Okay,
so favourite of the four Sex and the City original gals. Who's your favourite of the four original Sex and the City gals? Who do you have an affinity to?
Yes.
Do you know what? I still feel so defensive of Carrie all the time. Yes. I feel like she gets such a hard ride by culture. And I think it's just such a well-played, brilliant role.
She's although really good in
it. I will say... Yeah. I do love her as well. I know that people find her really annoying and self-obsessed or whatever. And you're like, well, obviously she's the narrator. Mm. But watching the new episodes of And Just Like That, I was like, gosh, they really are trying to make the point that Carrie drops one-liners constantly. Like so many quips.
Oh.
Like, I feel that they've amped up that a little bit because they're like,
really?
That's Carrie's.
Oh,
And literally everything she says is like a funny aside.
Yeah.
It's because she's got a podcast.
That can be a bit much. I always find it. Oh, how's the podcast going?
Well, she's shagging the producer.
Okay.
Aaron?
She's pretty upset about the scripts that she's got to read. She's like wanting to not. Do you mind a spoiler here?
I'm wondering if your audience will, but go on.
Yeah. No, they'll both be out when this drops because it's out next Thursday.
Okay.
She's not loving writing scripts for the podcast, for the advertising piece. She feels editorially compromised occasionally.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Yes. That is peak Carrie Bradshaw. Yes. Like, remember when she, like, it took her 2 weeks to write a 500-word piece about bags?
Oh, no. And then she got so offended that they gave her edits. That was like marks on the paper.
Totally. And then she was assaulted.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's the same episode.
We don't talk about that enough.
No, that was unfortunate.
Assuming I thought you might have watched the episode, so I did have a note in my doc saying, ask Caroline about what she thought of the pickup line to Nia. Is that how I say her name?
Nia Wallace.
Nia gets picked up at a bar by a very handsome man, and it's literally so smooth. And I was just going to ask you whether how your boyfriend and you met and whether you've ever been the lucky recipient of a actually good pickup line.
Oh, we met because it was quite a scandal at the time.
Oh my gosh.
We met working in advertising. He was the designer and I was the copywriter on Lemsip ads.
Oh, wow.
I had a boyfriend at the time.
Ooh.
And I get his kind of side job at the agency was that he was a photographer as well, so he used to take all the pictures for the staff IDs. And I had to go up to his little dark studio room and sit on the stool, and like I saw him and I just thought, he's the fittest man I've ever seen.
Is this why illicit relationships play so heavily in your fiction?
Possibly so. And then we realized, you know, quickly that like it wasn't going to happen because I had a boyfriend.
Was there an immediate spark?
Yeah, like it was
from the moment you took your picture.
Yeah, totally. And I think as well, I think you know, and what was cute as well, because I went back to my desk and then he called me at my desk phone and he was like, "Oh, sorry, is that Caroline? You know, you I've actually erased the card or whatever. You have to come back up at the end of the day."
Was that a lie?
Yeah, it was. And he was going to ask me out. And then I talked, well, he was taking my photo again about my boyfriend.
Oh.
I think possibly because I thought it was headed that way. Because we were just two people who just wanted to fuck. It was like, just instantly, it was like, I've never experienced it with anybody else in my life.
So fun.
And now you're getting married this year.
No, I know. But like, we spent a year then being pals. And
how
it was like,
you just be pals? Was it like
it was horrible.
A deeply inappropriate friendship.
It was
in your mind.
It was quite, I feel really bad because the boyfriend I was with was an incredibly lovely man. And I before I met Gavin, I really thought I was going to marry him. Like, we were together for 3 years, you know, and we lived together and it was nice. And then I just, it was just like a wallop of just human chemistry just fell on top of us.
And was the final, when you were both free to do as you pleased?
Yes.
Was it as great as you hoped?
Yeah.
Oh, thank God. I guess if it wasn't, you wouldn't probably
be
together.
Just, there was just so much pent up energy and there was just, and I think as well that like, it's possibly
a year of sexual frustration.
Yeah. And also that year we were just becoming really good pals and he was going on Tinder the whole time. So I was constantly hearing about like dates he was going on.
Oh,
it was
no.
just awful. And and then it's like, I think a big part of us being together so long and me still feeling like a competition winner is that like, I fancied him for so long. And it was like destroying my life and body that I fancied him so much, you know, it was just... I was thinking, he was the last thing I thought about every night and the first thing I thought about every night.
Oh my God,
I was
so
obsessive.
Cute.
Yeah, and I'm still obsessed with him.
You're literally in your own rom-com.
I am! I'm in a rom-com! I'm going to Cleveland!
Oh my God, I love that. And does he love Sex and the City as much as you do?
No, God, no. We are into very different things. But he's very much, he had a really art school background.
Okay.
And so he just like loves visual art and loves painting and things of that
nature.
Has
he painted you?
He hasn't painted. Has he painted me? In fact, I have to pause. He's definitely done some illustrated bits.
I once drew me and my boyfriend for our like second year anniversary, and it genuinely one of the most hideous things I've ever seen. He hasn't kept it.
Oh,
yeah. Well, it wasn't good.
Nice sentiment.
Yeah, that was it.
You have a dog, right, as well?
Yeah.
There must be portraits of the dog, surely.
There are portraits of the dog. Yes.
Oh. Okay, yeah. So.
To finish, can we ask you for some culture recos?
Mm. Oh, yeah.
What are you watching at the moment? Have you seen anything you particularly love?
Do you know what I just watched? I shouldn't have watched it on a hangover. It was the new Brooke Shields documentary.
Oh,
Pretty Baby. Do you know much about her?
Yes, I have seen stuff about this. Yeah.
Quite depressing.
Yeah. It's kind of a really fascinating thing because like the thing about her is that like she was held up as a sex symbol when she was like 10 years old.
Yes, with that strange film with the two children on a desert island.
The Blue Lagoon.
Yeah. And then there was also the one where she played a child prostitute.
Pretty Baby. Yeah,
oh, that's it. Oh, that's it. Of course.
When I was a kid, even though she would have been the generation before, I was obsessed with her just because I thought she was so beautiful. And also you just never see people your own age acting like that way on screen. You know, it's like generally if you're seeing an actor that age, it's like very Disney-fied. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I just was fascinated by her when I was a kid. And so watching the documentary was brilliant now. And there was so much controversy at the time that she was being treated as a sexual object as a very, very young person. Mm. And
by her own mother.
Yeah, her mother was like,
complicit.
Well, obviously, not just complicit. She was like, you know, putting her up for these things or whatever. And the way that Brooke, as a very clever, like 55-year-old woman now, sort of frames it, she's like, what's interesting is that like, yes, I was young, but like I understood art. Like I watched Fellini movies with my mother. I understood the purpose of art. I, for the most part, had quite positive experiences on my film set. And also like we were a single parent household. It was how we got like our car and our rent and like we couldn't make that kind of money any other way. So she has quite a level, you know, attitude towards it. But then she's like, then, you know, everybody all over the world was so worried about her safety and her image when she was a child, and then the minute she hit 20, she was like raped instantly by a producer.
Oh my god!
Sorry, this is really heavy.
Oh my god!
But and she was like, and she's like, and I had no one to turn to, and like no one cared, and everybody was just like, zip it, you know?
Oh my god, that is dark.
So and it's sorry, that's so fascinating. Dark. And I know this is like, no. like a lighter tone
no,
podcast.
But, hey, we talk about quite a lot of dark
yes,
things.
We do.
But I was so fascinated because it was like we have such a narrow window for when we decide it's like. Will we be protective over women?
Yeah.
It's like, what is, like, really, what is the difference between 17 and 20? It's like, yeah. everyone was worried about her when she was 17, and everyone's like, well, fair game, when she's 20. It's like,
yeah.
Yes, it's like,
it's nuts.
It's like the Millie Bobby Brown thing of like, as soon as she turned 18, people were like posting horrible comments about what they do to her.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Ugh. So, ugh. On a lighter note, can you give us your best piece of celeb gossip? Guys, PSA, we have to tell you about London's hottest new hack that is a game changer for date night and will be music to the ears of all the foodies listening, I promise.
Yes, honeys, you know that we love a fancy meal here at Straight Up. So, Yonder is a premium lifestyle credit card and our new sponsor. And hear us out, this isn't just any ordinary credit card. The points you earn can be spent at some of London's best restaurants, cafes, bars, and entertainment hotspots. And new members can try Yonder out for free for the first 6 months.
Bargain. The money you spend using the card from your weekly food shop to your summer holiday converts directly into points that you can then spend at these incredible places, from Bow to Cricket to Crossbows to Lena Stores, you name it.
Now, I've had credit cards with convertible points before, but they're always so limiting in terms of where you can spend them. It's business hotels or boring brands that feel quite irrelevant or, quite frankly, just way too expensive. Yonder is the first credit card that lets you spend points in the places that you'd actually want to go anyway.
Trust me, guys, it's so good that when my boyfriend first got Yonder and took me out for a free dinner with his points, so romantic, I immediately reached out to Yonder myself to see if they partner with us because I had to tell you about it.
It's also genuinely an amazing way to discover new restaurants or try new things in London, particularly since the experiences have changed up every month. I, for one, have booked to go to a pasta workshop at a restaurant in Shoreditch using my points, and it's definitely not something I would do otherwise. Very exciting.
Very exciting, babe. Similarly, my boyfriend and I went to Soho's new super cute, cozy British restaurant Sussex on Sunday evening, which I definitely wouldn't have done otherwise. I would be at home, pigging out on a delivery, feeling sorry for myself.
So, the details. After you've passed a six-month free trial, the card costs £15 a month, which may seem like a lot if you don't already pay for a premium credit card, but something that immediately makes the cost worth it for me is the fact that the monthly premium includes worldwide travel insurance and you can use the card abroad with no FX fee, no matter what the currency.
Considering I pay similar travel insurance anyway and rack up about £15 in currency conversion fees every time I go abroad, it was a no-brainer for me.
Head to yondercard.com to download the app and try Yonder for free for your first 6 months, plus get £5 to spend on one of Yonder's treat experiences. Approval is subject to eligibility and you need to be over 18 and a UK resident to apply. A membership fee and T's and C's apply. Borrow responsibly. The representative rate is 64% APR variable. So go get earning those points.
Thank you to our partner Yonder.
Oh.
As long as you say allegedly,
yeah,
you'll be fine. That's what we were like. Yeah. Allegedly, allegedly, allegedly. We heard that allegedly. So and so.
Oh God, I can think of a few, but like, I don't want to get you in trouble.
We keep hearing quite unfortunate things about David Walliams recently.
Oh, yeah. All true.
Mm. Yes.
What's your relationship now with celeb culture? Do you engage? Are you someone that looks at celebrity gossip?
I don't really look at celebrity gossip because I feel like I'm in the privileged position of having enough people in the world. Like,
you get like
journalist
the real
friends.
Gossip.
Yeah, yeah, you get the good stuff.
You don't need the sidebar of shame.
Exactly. Although my relationship to it has changed because like, particularly like being friends with someone like Dolly, for example, who is like a legitimate famous person. Yeah. Like there's a difference between like, you know, once a week a girl coming up to you in the street saying she loves your podcast and like literally you're going to hear Dolly like every 50 paces somebody comes up to her in the street. And
is it specifically in London or literally everywhere in the UK?
Everywhere. Like I've been to like Greek islands with her and people are like coming up to her, you know. And I can I remember one time I was on like a sun lounger with her and I could see this girl, she had her book and she was like reaching back trying to catch a conversation and I was like, that's such a hard way to go through the world thinking that like everybody wants to have a little story about you, you know.
Like, oh god, I can't actually just have a conversation in public without people being like, I heard Dolly Alderton say that XYZ.
And like obviously she's just like, you know, my mate and like the most like wonderful like kindest person that I know. And like the idea that like people, and I see this, I feel so protective of her sometimes when I'm out with her, that people just want little bits of her and to have their little story when they go away. And I feel like a bit of a, like, you know, protective or something, you know.
Has that changed your perception then of fame in a way, having such a close friend and
it
seeing
has,
it like
that? It taught me that I wouldn't be able for it. I think.
Really? You wouldn't ever
want to. Because I think she has this level of success that one happens like once in a generation with authors. Like the idea that you could like have your memoir adapted by the BBC within your lifetime and you would be producing and writing it and having a bunch of best-selling books and like being so... like authors aren't that recognisable facially, do you know what I mean? The idea that like... And I realize, and like, I think lots of authors in the world would be like, oh God, if only I had what she had. But when you are up close to it, you realize that like, it's just, it's not like being the most important person in the room. It's like having 100,000 people think that you're their PA.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Okay, yeah. They want things from you all the time. Yeah. And she's so gracious with it, but I couldn't do it without like snapping at people, I think.
One of my friends who works in publishing was at a dinner with her once and she was like, she has this like star power. She was like, it's like she's like luminous. She was like, her entire face and hair and everything like radiates. Like, she literally is glowing.
Yeah.
And I think she does. And I think she is also probably gets it because she's so recognizable as like, she's so striking.
Yeah, she's really tall.
She's so tall. Like, and she's so beautiful.
Like, she's 6 foot tall and she wears like 4-inch heels everywhere she goes.
How do you feel then about like women's personal journalism? I'm sure Dolly has said this in the past that mining your personal life as a young female writer obviously is exactly what all the editors want and you're encouraged to do. But sometimes once you have a bit of perspective when you're in your 30s, you can look back and think, oh, I wish I didn't like mine my personal life so much.
Totally.
Is that something you've done as a writer?
Yes, I feel completely, I feel so lucky that everything, because when I was working at the Pool, I would often write, you know, one or two pieces a day. And a lot of it was like, it was all just very click driven and stuff. And I was a young woman and I was desperate to get my name out there as a writer or whatever. And so I would, there was nothing I wouldn't give them if I had like depression, if I had like a bad smear test, if I, anything, like I was like, just take it, take it, take it. And they took it and I did. And I also like, I don't want to be too negative. I did really well there. And I have the career that I have now because like, my journalism got noticed, journalism, like in quotes, basically my personal essays with a new spin, got, you know, recognized by an agent and publisher. And like, that's why I have the career that I have now. But I'm also so glad that it's wiped. Like, it's nowhere.
Oh, you know? Yes. Like, that's actually a silver lining.
Yeah. That's kind of worth the 1500 quid you're still owed in a way.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. I love it. Because it's just like, if you're looking at my, you know, if you came to my work now and we're looking at my biography, it just looks like I just emerged in 2018. You know, it's like
an overnight success story.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sexiest way to break through.
Totally.
So I know through research that you are sort of very good at tarot and in fact give tarot readings and teach tarot, which is amazing.
It's a weird sideline.
Do you make money from, as in, is that
I make money from it if you count the YA books that I write and sell. I got into it when I was about 25. Me and my friends were all going through a really tough time because our friend was dying, and I think we just spent a lot of time just, I don't really remember going to any clubs in my 20s because so much of it was sitting around waiting for news or sitting around deconstructing the news we just received, you know? And the tarot just happened that around that time. I was on a weekend away with a pal. I found a deck and I kind of had a relationship with it when I was a teenager. So I vaguely remembered the principles. And then I just sort of taught myself off books. And then my other friend, Jen Cowney, she liked it so much that she took herself to like a proper course on it. And she got like a degree in tarot. So there's like quite a few of us now who just are really well versed in it. And I found it like gave me a lot because I grew up Catholic and I've always just really responded to, you know, mythology and stories and, you know, having a story for your feelings, you know. And that really, I still write about it and I still like, you know, use it when I'm teaching kids creative writing. It's really fun to like see what they come up with based on that stuff. But I don't actually practice myself anymore because I don't feel quite as adrift anymore, I think.
Interesting.
I love that.
Yeah, thanks.
Do you have somewhere that you can recommend that we should go? Because we've literally been talking about this loads on air recently, that we want to go and have a reading.
We want to have one live.
You can do it literally in Selfridges. But we were like, is that a slightly antithesis to the spirit of...
Yeah, I wouldn't.
It's like going to...
I think, okay, first of all, for anyone looking for a tarot reading, I would say adjust your expectations first. Because I think the best tarot readings, it's not like a cold reading thing where it's like, oh, you know, you're going to meet someone and you're going to go on a trip or whatever. Which all the bad ones, they say that. They say you're going to meet someone and they say you're going to go on a trip. which we're always meeting people and we're always going on trips. So it's like... how a general tarot reading will go is that, like, you know, the 5 or 6 cards come up or whatever, and it'll be like, okay, well, you know, first of all, I'm seeing a lot of, you know, wands here, which indicate sort of passion and career and enthusiasm towards things, but I'm also seeing a lot of fives, and fives mean, you know, conflict, and it's a kind of, you sort of you create a sort of a big vision board of what these cards are trying to say in the now, and then you sort of ask questions and you dig deeper. And I would say to you, like, okay, well, you know, this is a Knight of Swords, but, like, you know, that means that someone who's driving towards something, but maybe it's they're driving towards an idea they had several months ago or several years ago, but they still think it's, like, important that they do it, but they've forgotten why they do it. And then you would go, okay, actually, yeah, I'm working on this book, and it's blah, you know what, you know, and then it becomes more of a constructive conversation rather than, like, a future telling thing. And I think, if you wanted to go for a reading in London, Treadwell's, I'd say, is probably your best place.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. Oh, great.
Thank you.
Because I know they also do courses. So, and my friend did the course there, and she's great. So, yeah.
Okay, nice. Perfect. Okay, amazing. And, like, finally, where are your favourite London hotspots? Do you have bars, restaurants that you love?
God, I once read a brilliant quote somewhere that said, the worst thing about having a favourite restaurant is going there for the third time.
Oh my God, it's so true, because it's never as good.
Yeah. I can't remember where I read it, but I thought it was so good. And I think that's, like, the London thing, because you have so much choice that, like, when you go somewhere for the third time, you feel like you're, you know...
It's a bit, like, boring almost,
isn't it? Yeah, and also everywhere just closes all the time, which is so sad. Yeah. There's so many restaurants that mean so much to me emotionally that don't exist anymore. Oh, do you know where I went for the first time the other week? And this is so bougie.
Go on.
And I will go there 2 more times and then get to go. Quo Vadis?
Yes. Ooh, yes. I have been there once.
So good.
Members Club, say hi.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like I've spent all my time in fucking Members Club.
You can go not as a member.
They've got a big restaurant and stuff. It's like, but also, it's like so cool old school members rather than like... Soho House, more the Groucho.
But yeah, everything was just so salty and fresh and just good. And God, I had this like pavlova that I can't stop thinking about. Oh. Do you know when you get a good pavlova
and
the top is really light but the base kind of chewy?
And soft. I love that.
It's so good.
Okay, what about bars? Give us one bar.
Where do I love to get pissed? I do love the Glasshouse Stores. It's my favorite, like, old boozer, because it's a Sam Smith's pub or whatever, but the it's on Lexington Street, and it's where me and Gav used to kiss when we were still secretive.
Oh, so cute.
Special memories.
It is a special memory.
So we
place.
Have a question from Alistair Campbell. Yes. We always finish by giving our new guest a question from our last guest.
Oh, right.
He didn't know it was going to be you. It's just we asked for a general question.
Okay, great.
His question was, how optimistic do you feel about the planet in 100 years' time?
Oh, for fuck's sake. Just a light question there.
We did tell him to try and end on a positive note. I think for him it is positive. He was optimistic.
He's generally optimistic about the future. Yes.
So the future of the, like, when you specify the planet, do you mean like the temperature and the crops and
exact
the population control and all that kind of shit?
Yes. His exact wording.
I was in a cab with somebody the other day at a literary festival, and they were like a climate person, and they were but like, you know, they wrote about it. They talked about it. That was why they were at the festival. And I was just like, it was a long day for everyone. And there was a few of us in a cab back to the station. And I was like trying to keep it. I was like, well, Jesus, we got great weather, didn't we? And he's like, he just kept talking about how the world was burning. And I was like, I don't know what you want me to do about it in the back of this cab right now, mate. Like,
yes, make you feel bad about the heat
wave. Not
much
I can say.
Yeah. And I told him about, like, you know, putting an offer in on a flat. And he's like, well, make sure, you know, talk about flood damage, because in a few years, that's going to be a problem for everybody. And he's like, mate, I'm trying. I'm working my ass off here.
Well, Alistair's question was, on a scale of 1 to 10, how hopeful are you that the planet will still be here in 100 years?
Yes. Bit different to the question I get.
Oh, the planet will be here.
In 100
whether
years.
Whether we will be
will
here.
Will we be on it?
Yeah, well, so why is he hopeful?
I think he was just saying that he's a general optimist about the future, specifically because, and this may ring true for you, going into schools as well, with his new book, which is like, But What Can I Do? All about galvanizing young people at getting into politics. He's been going to a lot of schools, and he said that actually meeting young people is what gives him faith, because actually young people are so engaged, they're so interested, they genuinely care about the world's problems, and that seeing them makes him feel
Yes,
optimistic.
I have to say I'm very excited for the massive deaths that we're going to experience of very old policymakers who and the sort of new wave of people coming up behind them. But like, I really hope that things aren't so rigidly formed that it's impossible for, because we all wanted change when we were 17, and we all came rooted up against, you know, structural changes that were just too difficult, and then we all bottomed out. Yeah. Like,
we get a bit tired.
I love the youth, and like, I spend a lot of time with them as well, and they are fantastic and they are interested, but also we can't put that much pressure on them either. It's fair to them. It's why they all have anxiety, you know.
That's very good point.
Alice has anxiety as well, to be fair.
But I do feel hopeful. I am optimistic in general. I feel like I don't read that much about it, but I feel like we're kind of the new science that's developing in order to erase this stuff feels very promising. But I also feel like I get really frustrated with, I used to get frustrated with when I was writing every day for a news outlet, was like, oh, you know, we were always like guilting women for buying too much, but society has made it this way. I mean, that was a big thing. Yeah. We're talking about like consumption and how much we're consuming or whatever. It's like, oh no, but like society pressures us. And it's like, at a certain point, we all have to sort of pull up our knickers and be like, stop fucking buying boohoo. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I just think there's no excuse. I don't, and people don't come at me like ringing the like, but money. It's like, I don't care. Like, loads of people have been broke forever and they still have fine clothes. Yeah. Like, like boohoo is not a rise. Like, I find it really hard to be friends with anyone who did that. Yes. Like, I really would.
Yes. Mm. Would shop at Shein.
Yeah. God, yeah. Is that terrible to say?
No, because I agree with you completely. And I would never wear anything from either of those places. And I think you can go to H&M.
I don't think I've ever shopped at Shein.
Far better. Yeah,
not perfect,
credentials,
obviously.
Not perfect, but...
But also, I have like... I have a dress from Primark that I bought 3 years ago that I still wear. It's like you can make fast fashion slow fashion, I think. Yes. You know? And I do think as women... And as a consuming class, we have to take responsibility for the amount of fucking clothes.
Like, I agree.
If we're responsible for one thing as a unit, it's the clothes bit, I think.
Yeah. And even the whole like push on vintage shopping and how you should just vintage shop instead. I think that's amazing. Obviously, we need like a circular economy within clothing. But still, like, you could just not buy some shit for a few months. Yeah. Like, you actually don't need to buy clothes like every 6 weeks. Like, it's not necessary.
Yeah.
Agreed. I still have I think things... Dresses that I bought last summer to me now still feel new anyway, because I only got to wear them like for that short amount of time that we had that was hot last year.
I've had this new look jumper for 10 years which is actually mildly embarrassing.
It's really kept its shape.
Do you have a question for our next guest? A general life question. It can be about fame, it can be about success.
Yeah, I would like to know their skincare regime.
Oh my god, great question.
Because I've only just got one and I'm really proud. For years I was like, I'm not doing it. I'm not buying into this fucking bullshit. Yes. And I do feel bad about buying into this fucking bullshit.
But then you turn 30.
And then I turn 30 and it's like, oh, I'm aging and I have acne. Wonderful.
Literally. Your skin is stunning.
Because of the regime.
Yeah. Okay, what's your hero product?
Sadly, it is a product I got from Sunday Riley, which is too expensive.
Oh, but very good nonetheless. That
really
blue
good.
Night
it's the vitamin C serum.
I have heard a lot of people talk about that.
I've stopped wearing foundation now because of the vitamin C serum.
Oh my god!
And
okay,
I feel
so
like it's actually
an investment.
It's paying for itself. Yeah. I think. Yeah.
Oh wow. Oh, okay, amazing. Well, Carmen, thank you so
much
for coming.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,